Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities." Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear, "Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you are already starting to see happen, then you had best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and He shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation." Today is January 31st, 2010, Sunday. Bill Fink is joining us for this, the sixth installment of Bolshevism in Russia. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Hello, praise Yahweh.
Absolutely, praise Yahweh. Now, do you recall exactly where we left off last week?
I believe we're at numbers 46 and 47. We were talking about Omsk, and we finished 46 and what was going on in Omsk in the east, and we're on 47. And if you want to read that, I got something I'd like to add to it when you read it.
All right, I'm turning there now. We said we left off on 47. That's right. We were dealing with the railway situation, the rail transport, and the dictatorship in Omsk. So we are now on 47. 47, General Knox to War Office, dispatch Vladivostok, March 2nd, 1919. Following received from Omsk, 26th February. Position of railway transport critical. Owing to absence of metals, coal, and spare parts, workshops on railways have ceased work. Passenger traffic continues only on Nikolaevsky Railway, only military and food trains running on other railways. Money being printed on colossal scale. 14,000 workmen employed in Petrograd and Penza day and night. 300 million notes of different valuations are said to be daily turned out. Peasants very hostile to Soviets' actions, and riots resulted in many quarters. Discipline growing stricter in army, return of shoulder straps and saluting being considered. In near future, the Bolsheviks intend closing all churches. Three priests were recently drowned by Reds in Osa. End report.
You know, in about a year and a half, the Bolsheviks totally destroyed Russian industry. And we saw early in this series from the Third Rome and Michael Raphael Johnson's work that Russia was a very industrious and it was a first world country. It had a big, heavy industry, a lot of manufacturing. It was very advanced. It was as advanced in many respects, more advanced than most of the other European nations, and it was right on a par with Germany. And I'd like to quote from we see that the Bolsheviks destroyed Russian industry, and we think that there was a big Russian military buildup in the 40s and 50s and 60s in the Cold War, but most of that technology came from us. You know, Khrushchev said that the capitalists would sell him the rope that he'd hang him with, and he was right. But it wasn't anything new he was saying. They had been doing it for 40 years already. And it's really just a pincher movement. You know, the Jewish capitalists using the Jewish communists to destroy the Christian. But I'd like to quote something from Eric Butler. Again, this is from the Library of General Moseley, and it's a pamphlet, a booklet called Censored History, and it's on the Mein Kampf site at christogeny.org. This is page 13 of a booklet that Eric Butler published. It was published in 1974. There was no such thing as Soviet technology. Almost all, perhaps 90 to 95%, came directly or indirectly from the United States and its allies. In effect, the United States and the NATO countries have built the Soviet Union, its industrial and its military capabilities. This massive construction job has taken 50 years, which means it started in 1924, right? It has been carried out through the trade and the sale of plants, equipment, and technical assistance. The United States is spending $80 billion a year on defense against an enemy built up by the United States and Western Europe. Even stranger, the United States apparently wants to make sure this enemy remains in the business of being an enemy. The Soviets have the largest merchant marine in the world, about 6,000 ships. I, meaning Eric Butler, have the specification for each ship. About two-thirds were built outside of the Soviet Union. About four-fifths of the engines for these ships were also built outside of the Soviet Union. About 100 Soviet ships are used on a Haiphong run. Now, this is during Vietnam, you know, the Vietnam War. To carry Soviet weapons and supplies for Hanoi's annual aggression. I was able to identify 84 of these ships. None of the main engines in these ships was designed and manufactured inside the USSR. All the larger and faster vessels on a Haiphong run were built outside the USSR. All Soviet automobile, truck, and engine technology comes from the West. The Gorky organization, built by the Ford and Austin companies, produced most of the trucks to carry Soviet-supplied military equipment down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Automobile factories can also be used to build tanks. And that's just the beginning of it. But
well, he wrote this in 51 or 54, didn't he? So when he said it's been on underway for 50 years, I think he's going all the way back to the Russo-Japanese War of 1904-1905.
Well, he may be, but I didn't see in this version it says first printing 1974, and I didn't see a date when it was actually printed. But he quotes some excellent sources. Well, it was written before. It was written after 1966 because he.
He's talking about Vietnam. Okay.
Right, that's the Vietnam War.
Okay, I thought you were still quoting from the Bloody Red Streak by David.
Oh, no. This is Eric Butler, Censored History.
Oh, okay.
Now, he quotes, you know, Carol Quigley's Tragedy and Hope, and he quotes The Naked Capitalist, and these things are no secret. They're only a secret from the blind American public that would rather watch a Yankees game than investigate what Washington's doing to them or investigate what's actually going on in the world. And the Bolsheviks clearly destroyed, and we've been, you know, covering many eyewitness reports of that, Russian industry, and they got all their industry from us. We gave it to them.
Well, I think that most Americans are fortunate in that they've historically been able to afford their uncaring, complacent attitude, since they don't live right next door to all the problems. You know, the people in Romania, Hungary, Poland, Ukraine, Latvia, they all had to care because the Soviets eventually came for them within a few years.
Well, absolutely, but we provided the vehicle. We provided the means for them to do that. We provided the means for communism to spread. We provided the means for Russia to arm the Vietnamese to kill American boys. We provided the means for Russia to crush Hungary and Czechoslovakia. We did that. And we did it because we allowed the Jews on Wall Street to do it.
Absolutely. And they would have us believe that we need to oppose communism in South Vietnam and oppose it in South Korea, where it really doesn't matter since the Asians could care less who governs them. They just want to make money. Yet we don't oppose communism in Southern Africa, where the whites are fighting tooth and nail, and they wanted to survive and they wanted freedom. And they were vehemently opposed to the communist regimes, and they had the support of most of the black population as well. Yet we went out of our way to equip, fund, and train the communists, and it often wound up that the U.S. was financing the same communists that the Soviets were financing.
Well, there's no doubt. I just had to get that in. You know, while we see the destruction of Russian industry, where later Russian mechanization came from, it came from us. We gave it to them, and they're our enemy. Well, they're not our enemy. The Jews on Wall Street make sure the public thinks that they're our enemy. In the meantime, it's the Jews on Wall Street that are the real enemy.
But there's a lot of money and power to be made from the fake Cold War.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it was a reason to militarize the company and keep it militarized and keep us at war and keep profiting from war profits, from war games.
And to keep attention always focused on the possibility of some mythical Soviet invasion that's never coming, while people don't realize that their neighborhood's being integrated and their daughter's being sent to school with a black.
Well, right. The invasion is already here. It's incredible. All right, I'll read the next report. From number 48, General Knox at the British War Office from Vladivostok, March 4th, 1919. An interview with an officer has appeared in a Vladivostok paper, which gives an idea of the ruin that has befallen Moscow. He had escaped through the lines and says that executions and arrests to say nothing of hunger and cold and robbery in all of its forms, are a part of the daily life of the city. The streets are filthy and torn up. Houses are shell-shattered and gutted by fire. Pocket-picking has become fashionable and is looked on as a harmless eccentricity. Officers are put on to the most menial forms of work, such as street cleansing, loading bricks at railway stations, and now a colonel is a night watchman. Whilst Kukush was in Bolshevik occupation, women from 16 to 50 were mobilized for work. And to satisfy the needs of the pride and flower of the revolution. In other words, women were like a commodity that were to be taken and used at the will of the Jew.
They were forced to become prostitutes, basically.
Well, not even, they weren't even getting paid for it. I mean,
free love.
There's not even, yeah, free love. It's the whole Soviet Jewish concept of free love goes back to the Bolshevik Revolution, and we saw it in Weimar Germany, and Wiebe talked about it in Germany and the Jewish Problem. It's a Jewish ideal, and it's a Canaanite ideal, and that's who the Jews are. They're Canaanites, and it could be traced right from the Old Testament all the way down through history to the Jews of today. To continue, at Goro Blagodatsky, the Red Army threw 44 bodies down a well. They were discovered later, and amongst them were found the bodies of a priest, some monks, and a young girl. At Blagoveshchensk, I'm destroying these names, officers and soldiers from Torbolov's detachment were found with gramophone needles thrust under their fingernails, their eyes torn out, the marks of nails on her shoulders where shoulder straps had been worn. Their bodies had become like frozen statues and were hideous to look upon. These men had been killed by Bolsheviks at Metsanovaya and taken thence to Blagoveshchensk. The following is a text of a document belonging to a Red Commissar captured at the front and quoted in local press. Quote, "Herewith I certify that the bearer, Comrade Evdomikov, is allowed the right of acquiring a young girl for himself, and no one may oppose this in any way. He is invested with full power, which I certify." Unquote. The Russian, right. The Bolshevik Revolution, the Jewish destruction of Christendom is all over lust for power, money, and sex. They don't want your votes. They want your daughters.
Isn't that what the Talmud tells them to do?
Well, absolutely. It's right from the Talmud. And if you think that the Talmud's not the wicked, most wicked book in the world, and if you think that the Jews don't practice the Talmud, well, look at the Bolshevik Revolution and read these accounts.
Right. Number 49, Sir C. Elliot to Earl Curzon, received March 7, dispatch, Vladivostok, March 5, 1919. Following from Council, Eddie Kartenberg, 3rd March. Following a summary of Bolshevik investigation at Perm, commencing from February 1918, factories were managed by labor committees, amongst whom criminals were to be found. Incapacity of these committees and general demoralization of laboring class brought about complete standstill of production and rise in prices from which whole population suffers. Quote, "Bolsheviks completely disorganized school establishments by appointing teachers by system of voting in which students and domestic employees of schools took part."
That sounds like the NEA here in America today.
"First-year law students appointed by Bolsheviks were placed magistrates in law courts. Bolshevik policy was characterized by persecution of all classes of population suspected of ill feeling towards them, especially well-to-do class and peasants. In spite of confiscation of their property, well-to-do classes were forced to pay huge contributions, and many of them were arrested as hostages on most futile pretexts, without any accusations being made against them, and frequently by caprice or personal spite of some Bolshevik commissary. Those who were not shot were incarcerated under disgraceful conditions where they were kept under perpetual dread of being murdered. During arrest of these people, their houses were pillaged. In villages, quote, poor committees, quote, were organized, representatives of which were supposed to be elected by peasants. Elections were, however, discarded tacitly by Bolsheviks, who appoint people almost exclusively of criminal classes. Contributions, requisitions, and other tyrannies were imposed by Bolsheviks on peasants possessing land or other property, which resulted in insurrections in villages suppressed by Bolsheviks by pillage, devastations, and massacres on large scale, notably at Septaichi and Pistor in Ahansk district, August 1918. Laborers opposing Bolsheviks were treated in the same manner as peasants. 100 laborers were shot at Matalivke near Perm, December 1918, for protesting against Bolshevik conduct. Peasants particularly suffered when Red Army retreated, Bolsheviks taking with them cereals, horses, and cattle available and destroying all agricultural and other instruments they were not able to take with them. Bolshevik persecution of anti-Bolshevik elements reached height of its fury after attempt on Lenin's life, although even previously it had developed into a reign of terror. Commissaries consisting of unintellectual laborers from 20 to 30 years old who condemned people to death without making any accusation against them frequently personally took part in murder of their victims. Russian authorities have only just commenced investigation of Bolshevik crimes, and therefore it is difficult to obtain precise data as to number of persons killed, although as far as we can judge, it runs into several thousands in Perm government. Victims were usually shot, but frequently drowned or killed by sword. Murder of groups of 30, 40, and 60 have taken place, for example, at Perm and Kugnar. Murders were frequently preceded by tortures and acts of cruelty. Laborers in Omsk, before being shot, were flogged and beaten with butts of rifles and pieces of iron in order to extract evidence. Victims were frequently forced to dig their own graves. Sometimes executioners placed them facing wall and fired several revolver shots from behind them near their ears, killing them after considerable interval. Persons who survived this gave evidence. Older women were amongst victims. Case of Miss Bakuyeva is an example. December 1918, this lady, 19 years old, was accused of espionage and tortured by being slowly pierced 13 times in the same womb by bayonet. She was afterwards found by peasants still alive, is now nearly cured, and has herself related her sufferings to us. Bolsheviks vented violent hatred on church and clergy, pillaged monasteries such as at Bielgorod and Bielgorodsky, turned churches into meeting places and workshops, persecuted and murdered priests and monks. Of 300 priests in liberated parts of Perm diocese, 46 were killed by Bolsheviks. End quote, end report.
I think that's probably not too bad that only 46 of 300 are killed. I would have expected I know that sounds cruel. I would have expected the ratio to be much higher.
But that's probably, just getting started, though.
Oh yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure another few years and there weren't any left because Christianity was basically outlawed in the Soviet Union.
They made anti-Semitism a capital offense, did they not?
Yes, they did.
I recall a letter that Lenin wrote to somebody who was inquiring about the status of Jews in the Soviet Union, and he said that, blah, 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 blah. Accordingly, anti-Semitism is now a capital crime in the Soviet Union, and we pursue anti-Jewish sentiment with all vigor and all due haste.
Well, it was a Jewish coup.
Absolutely.
There's no doubt about it. Sir C. Eliot. And if, I have a book on my site that shows that it was definitely a Jewish coup. And he lists every Jew. And he does a very conservative job because he doesn't have Stalin as a Jew. And the name of the book is Jews in Russia and in the USSR. And he has a supplement where he lists all the Jews in Russian government, in all the branches of the federal, the Soviet government, from 1936 until 1939. And it's, even at, 20 years after the Bolshevik Revolution, it's still overwhelmingly Jewish. The Party Control Commission of the Central Committee of the CPSU is like 20 Jews and 3 non-Jews and a question mark. And that's typical. It's incredible. the commissariat of heavy industry is half Jewish, and they don't know anything about heavy industry.
Now, what about the workers in heavy industry?
The members of the board are all Jewish, every single one of them. Like it's like 14 out of 14. Yeah, the workers in heavy industry are probably 0%
Jewish.
Yeah, and every department is like that. It's incredible. And that was 20 years after the Bolshevik Revolution.
Well, from the booklet, Judaism and Bolshevism, there's a quote here. Of the 224 revolutionaries who in 1917 were dispatched to Russia with Lenin to foment the revolution, 170 were Jews. According to the Times of 29 March 1919, of the 20 or 30 commissaries or leaders who provided the central machinery of the Bolshevik movement, no less than 75% are Jews. According to official information from Russia, in 1920, out of 545 members of the Bolshevist administration, 447 were Jews. I'd say that's pretty amazing, wouldn't you? 447 out of 544, that's 82% Jewish.
Well, the Bolshevik War was a war on... What was the Bolshevik Revolution was... A revolution. It was a war on Christendom, perpetrated by the Jews, and masked in behind political slogans and political dogmas, but it was all Jewish, absolutely, and all of these crimes that we've recounted here lay on the shoulders of the Jews.
And we'll never see a movie come out of Hollywood about this, will we?
No, absolutely not. Not in this age. We will in the next age, I'm sure.
And certainly we'll never see it in historical textbooks either. I mean, I had an entire chapter in a AP history book, and it was on American history, and it was devoted to the Holocaust. And I had to wonder, what does the Holocaust have to do with U.S. history?
Nothing at all.
I mean, even if you believe that it happened, we were neither party to it, nor involved in it, nor a victim of it. So why do they devote an entire chapter in an American historical textbook? It's not even European history, it's American history. They devote an entire chapter to the Holocaust, but they don't mention anything about the Communist Revolution other than a paragraph that, you know, the Bolshevik Revolution began and blah, 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 and this would later lead to the Cold War.
And when they have to mention the Bolshevik Revolution, they claim that they blame it on the Tsar.
Mm-hmm.
The Jews love taking crimes and blaming them on the victim. They love doing that. Whenever you see somebody blaming the victim for a crime, know that there's a Jew behind it, and that's Jewish public relations. That's the working modus operandi of Jewish public relations is to blame the victim for the crime.
Isn't that what the ACLU specializes in?
Absolutely. That's what they exist for, is to blame the victims for the crime. White women get raped, it's their fault. Black women claim, you know, cry that they were molested, and 30 white guys get suspended from school. It's incredible. And a white woman gets raped and she asked for it. Oh, she asked for it. She deserved it. She was wearing a short skirt. Of course, the black girl that got molested was a stripper. It's an incredibly hypocritical society, Jewish society. And we have to keep pointing it out.
Absolutely, but that's the leaven of the Pharisees, hypocrisy.
Well, absolutely. That's Yahshua Christ, his major crime. Yeah, you know, his major indictment he leveled against him in Matthew 23 over and over again. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. Report number 50. This kind of wraps it up to the British Embassy reports. Sir C. From Petrograd, anyway, I'm sorry. Sir C. Elliott to Earl Curzon, received March 26th. Following from counsel at Ekaterinburg, March 20th, have now completed our report on the Bolsheviks. Enclosures comprise Russian counsel's unbiased evidence of nearly 100 witnesses, 20 photographs of atrocities committed by the Bolsheviks, and other documentary evidence obtained from Russian authorities. I wish he'd have went into length about what that was. Persons of all classes, especially peasants, continue to come to this consulate, giving evidence of the murder of their relatives and other outrages that Bolsheviks in their fury have wrought, but owing to the necessity of limiting work in order to complete the report, they've been obliged to curtail taking further evidence. In other words, there was so many reports pouring in, the Brits couldn't keep up with it. So they had to cut them off. Details given in my recent telegrams may be taken as characteristic of the manner by which the Bolsheviks murdered innocent citizens, and therefore, for reasons above mentioned, unless I hear from you to the contrary, I shall desist from sending you further names. From the reports received, murder and pillage committed by the Bolsheviks during their retreat from this front assumed most terrible proportions.
All right. Number 51.
I'll read it a little later. That's okay. There's plenty of time.
Number 51, extract from report by a British chaplain. With the oncoming of the Austro-German armies into South Russia last spring, my experiences of Bolshevism entered on a new phase. Previously, I had for many months lived in the terrorized city of Odessa, where the cowed and despoiled population had been bullied into abject submission to a brutal and despotic Bolshevik tyranny. And I'd like to just pause here and point out that Odessa is basically the epicenter of Jewry in the Ukraine, isn't it?
Well, you know, right. It was a big, because it's a big trade city. And wherever you see a big trade city, you're going to see a lot of Jews.
Mm-hmm.
It's
absolutely
like New York. Yeah, New York was the big trade city for the first 250, 300 years of this nation's colonization, and that's why there's so many Jews proportionately in New York.
The city had been drenched with blood. Murders and outrages in the streets as well as houses were of daily, even hourly occurrence. Trade was paralyzed, shops looted, and bourgeois arrested, tortured, and done to death by hundreds under circumstances of fiendish cruelty. The Allied consuls had left, and the majority of the foreigners, when a general massacre of the educated population was arranged to commence with the extermination of 108 families. This last brutality was averted by the arrival of armies of the Central Powers. So here we see that we're to believe that the Germans were throwing babies in the air and catching them on bayonets in Belgium, and that they had to halt the Hun from raping all the Belgian women, yet the Germans arrive and put an end to the massacre of Slavs by Jews and other Slavs and Chinese and Lats.
And this is the first report we've seen here from Odessa. I mean, we've seen a few reports that talked about the Ukraine in general, but this is the first specific report from Odessa.
Undoubtedly, the rapidly accumulating horrors were deliberately incited by the secret German Bolshevik agents in order that the advancing Austrian armies might not be met as foes but welcomed as deliverers coming to save the people from a tyranny more brutal than anything Russia had previously known. The scheme was entirely...
Well, let's talk about that a second, because he's basically saying that the Germans, he's blaming these crimes on the Germans.
That can't be, though, since these crimes were happening all the way in Vladivostok.
Well, right. They were happening all over the place. And perhaps he's misled that, you know, some of these Jews might be speaking German or have a German, a German origin geographically, but they're not German.
Absolutely.
That there were no reports of German agents anywhere else perpetrating any crimes like this.
They might be Jewish agents from Germany, but they're not German agents from Germany.
Well, that's what I would think. This guy's a British chaplain, and mainstream Judeo-Christians, even at that time, are very hesitant to ever leverage any kind of accusation against God's chosen people. I mean, that's just not possible. They can't be doing anything like that. I think I think this report's definitely biased.
Absolutely. The old British-German rivalry, we can see it clearly. The scheme was entirely successful. The Austrian troops were received as saviors. The intrigue was cleverly managed. Nothing had been left to chance. All possibility of effective armed opposition had been rendered impossible by the enormous massacres of Russian officers previously systematically incited by the German propagandists.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I want to get this while it's timely. Earlier, you know, he talks about the advancing Austrian armies being seen, you know, being welcomed as deliverers. Well, we have and this will show the bias in this particular report again, we have an earlier testimony from Madame X in report number 34 here that we covered a couple of weeks ago. And she said that the arrival of the Austro-German armies in February 1918 put an end to the craze for rapine and robbery.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't blame any of the rapine and the robbery on German agents. And she was an eyewitness to it, and she blamed it all on Jewish Bolsheviks.
Well, absolutely. It was going on everywhere across Russia. It was going on before the Germans arrived. It was going on after they were expelled.
Right. And I just want to point out, you know, that not all of these reports are, you know, some of them have to be taken a little critically.
Yes. The march into the southern Ukraine was another stage in a Vienna intrigue, which has been moving forward for the last 40 years, the design for expansion to the east and access to the Black Sea. Within 3 days of the arrival of the Austrian army in Odessa, the soldiers were sent into the city with orders to fraternize with the inhabitants, to conduct themselves with marked courtesy and self-restraint, and to meet all friendly advances with conciliatory affability. What would he prefer? Would he prefer that they just come in and act like the Bolsheviks?
Yeah, really.
It seems that if they're horrible, they're horrible. And if they're nice, well, they're only being nice as part of a ruse.
Right, well, maybe this British chaplain's a crypto-Jew or something himself.
The Russian Bolshevik troops fled at the approach of the Austrians. Of course, they're cowards. The Black
Sea. Well, that reminds me of, you know, walking into a room full of roaches and turning a light on, you know. That's, you know, Satan operates in the dark, and when the light comes, Satan just disperses and scatters.
Well, they were good for killing harmless peasants and raping young girls, but they're not good for fighting German and Austrian soldiers.
No. Cowards don't fight with real men, and cowards rape young girls.
The Black Sea fleet left the morning Odessa was surrendered. Some of the ships were so heavily laden with plunder they could scarcely make way. A large proportion of the worst Bolshevik criminals of the district, together with the more notorious bands of assassins and highwaymen, escaped with the fleet. Two of the crews, having murdered their officers sometime before, were unable to navigate their vessels until help was sent from other ships. That's just like the Jew that cut off the nose to spite the face.
Absolutely.
The Bolshevik flagship took on board the entire company from the two largest houses of ill fame in the city, together with their private orchestra. I assume that means prostitutes?
It very well could be.
For 3 days before the Austrians marched into Odessa, the Bolsheviks had divers at work from the imperial yacht Almas and the cruiser Sinope dragging the harbor for the weighted bodies of murdered officers, of whom about 400 had been done to death, the majority after torture with boiling steam, followed by exposure to currents of freezing air. Others were burnt alive, bound to planks, which were slowly pushed into the furnaces a few inches at a time. In this way perished General Chormakov and many others of my acquaintance. The bodies now recovered from the water were destroyed in the ship's furnaces that no evidence might remain to be brought before the Austro-Germans. Later, a member of the Austrian staff told me that they had been supplied with a list of the names of over 400 murdered officers from the Odessa district, January 1919.
They're just destroying all Christendom. That's what the Jews are doing. And it's everywhere. It's all over Russia. It's, you know, just because all those initial reports came from Petrograd and Ekaterinburg and Perm, well, that doesn't mean it's not, it's the way the lines of communication are, but that doesn't mean it's not all over the place.
Absolutely.
It's going on everywhere in Russia. Report number 52, MM to Earl Curzon. I have the honor to report that the food question in Moscow is growing more and more acute every day. Nominally, the population of the city has to obtain its food by the card system, cards of three categories having been introduced and the quantity of food available distributed in the following proportions. Category 1, those working manual labor, 4. Category 2, those working intellectual labor, 3. Category 3, those having no employment, 2. The difficulty, however, is that no food except black bread is available for distribution. So I guess they would get it in those proportions, 4, 3, and 2. 3/8 of a pound of bread for the second and 1/4 of a pound of bread for the third categories is completely insufficient to keep one alive. So it was even worse than those proportions. Other foodstuffs must be obtained from speculators at exorbitant prices. The seller as well as the purchaser running the risk of a heavy fine or imprisonment if denounced as traffic in foodstuffs is strictly forbidden. Thousands of men and women are going daily to distant country places with the object of purchasing and bringing into town some provisions, thus disarranging the regular railway traffic. We read a very similar report earlier in this series. It is, however, not an easy matter to bring provisions into Moscow as cordons of soldiers are searching passengers' luggage at country stations and will take away, at their discretion, anything they think is superfluous. To illustrate the high cost of living at Moscow, I beg to enclose here with a list of the foodstuffs which are still obtainable, together with the prices at which they were sold. Black bread, 12 to 14 rubles per pound. Now, I don't have a real good comparison, but before the Bolshevik Revolution in 1913, M. Raphael Johnson was saying that the direct taxation per capita was 3.1 rubles per year on the average Russian citizen.
Yes.
And that it would cost $75 per year to go to a Russian university as compared with $1,000 at an American university.
And I'd like to point out that the ruble was worth, prior to the revolution, approximately 50 cents. One U.S. dollar would get you 2 rubles.
Well, I know at that time that a loaf of bread was going for a nickel.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay, and here a pound of bread is going for 12 to 14 rubles, which would be $7. So, well, let's just he doesn't give consumer prices, Johnson, in that book, so it's hard to make a comparison. But we can understand that 14 rubles for a pound of black bread is simply ridiculous. White bread, not obtainable. So they weren't doing any wheat processing, were they? Rye flour, 15 to 16 rubles per pound. Wheat flour, 20 to 25 rubles per pound. A meal, 15 to 20 rubles. Rice, 40 rubles per pound. Potatoes, 4 to 5 rubles per pound. Carrots, 3 to 4 rubles per pound. Sugar, anything that has to be imported is going to be extremely high, 90 to 100 rubles per pound. Butter, 100 to 120 rubles per pound. Tea, 90 to 100 rubles per pound. Sunflower oil, 40 to 45. Horse flesh, 12 to 16 rubles per pound. That's cheaper than the flour. You could eat meat cheaper. Beef, 27 to 30 rubles per pound. Mutton, 30 to 35 rubles per pound. Now this is odd. Pork, 40 to 45 rubles. It's worth more than horse, beef, or lamb. Lard and bacon, 70 to 80 rubles per pound. Yeah, pork, I'm surprised in such a Jewish country that you know, where Jews are the only ones that can buy food, that pork is so expensive. That they, you know, the Russian Christians, they're trying, that shows you right there, they're just trying to starve the Russian Christians. Because pork should be half the price of the beef and the mutton. Lord Kilmarnock to Earl Curzon, February 24th. Report number 53. I have the honor to transmit herewith translations of 2 further reports on the atrocities committed by the Bolsheviks in the Baltic provinces. And we're going to get into Estonia now and what's going on there, which have been furnished me by the Estonian provisional government here. I also enclose 7 photographs of the victims of massacres by the Bolsheviks at Wessenberg and Dorpat from the same source. Now, bear in mind that many of the Bolshevik army are considered to be Estonians and mm-hmm. Lithuanians. And here the Bolsheviks are committing atrocities in Estonia.
Well, I'd like
while
to point
they
out
have
that
Estonians back there in Russia fighting for them.
Lithuania had a huge Jewish population at the time. I wouldn't be at all surprised if Lithuania was 15 or 20% Jewish in 1918.
Well, that's quite high, and it's possible that many of those letters soldiers were Jews. Bolshevik atrocities in Estonia. On the 25th of December, the Bolsheviks shot the steward, Karu, the foreman and the housekeeper of the Kilsey estate. Before death, the victims were cruelly tortured. Besides these, the author, Waldemar Rosenstrock, and three other persons were shot. According to the report from a leader of an attacking squadron, Lieutenant Jacobson, so he's not a, he doesn't sound like an Estonian, the Bolsheviks murdered two brothers, Hendrik and Hans Kokomal, of Piksar on the 26th of January. They crushed the head of the former by two blows of an axe and shot the latter. Besides this, they robbed the victims of their clothes and boots and tore their linen, which, being bloodstained, was useless to them. In Sagnitz, in the Walk district, the head forester, Hess, and the bookkeeper, Wickman, were shot by the Bolsheviks. Now, all these Estonians have German names. As well as the graves of these two victims, seven more were discovered in the same place. The bloodbath in Walk. I guess Walk is a town in Estonia. Bolsheviks raged more in Walk than anywhere else, as the Bolsheviks remained longest in power there. The number of persons murdered by them is great, but not definitely known. At all events, they are estimated at from 350 to 450. Besides, 600 to 700 persons were carried off by the Bolsheviks. From the report of the inhabitants of the district, these unfortunates were murdered on the way. The murders were committed in the same manner as elsewhere. The unfortunates, who belonged to different classes of society, were arrested on all sorts of pretexts, kept prisoners a few days, and then, in groups of 20 to 30, led out of the town to the place of execution, where graves already prepared for them. Every night, 20 to 30 persons were executed without examination or trial. Before being shot, the victims were tortured in every possible way. All the bodies bear marks of many bayonet thrusts as well as gun wounds. The skulls are shattered and the bones broken. Even after death, when bodies were stiff, the Bolsheviks hacked off the arms and legs and broke the bones of their victims. The Bolsheviks have instilled such terror into the hearts of the local inhabitants that they dare not even talk of the Bolsheviks' deeds, and therefore it is difficult to obtain a true report of all their atrocities in Walk. An Estonian soldier of cavalry was taken prisoner by the Bolsheviks and was to be executed in Walk along with many others. The Bolshevik bullets, which killed so many of his comrades, did not hit him, and he succeeded after the murder to escape from the common burial place. He describes one of those terrible bloodbaths in the following manner. They took our caps, coats, and cloaks. 35 armed Bolsheviks surrounded us in order to prevent any attempted escape. Our hands were bound behind our backs. Besides this, we were fastened in couples, and then each pair joined by a long rope so that we marched all attached to the one rope. Thus, we were led to death. As I protested against this barbaric treatment, the Bolshevik officer struck me twice on the head with a riding whip and said, "Shooting is too good for you. Your eyes ought to be put out before death." At the word of command, the Bolsheviks fired a volley. The bound group fell to earth. I also was pulled down by the others, though I had not been hit. The Bolsheviks fired four rounds on the fallen. Fortunately, I again was missed. Then the executioners fell upon us like wild animals to rob us. Anyone who still moved was finally killed by bayonets or blows from the butt ends of rifles. I kept as still as possible. One of the Bolsheviks took my boots. Another looked at my stockings. "Good stockings," he murmured, and pulled them off.
I found some information about the town of Valk, the village anyway. It's called Valga in the Estonian language. And there was a battle fought there during the Estonian War of Independence. And I'm reading from your Wikipedia here. 683 Estonians and Finnish volunteers attacked 1,200 Bolshevik soldiers. And during a several-day battle, they drove the Bolsheviks out. They lost about 156 of their own men. They killed several hundred Bolsheviks. And then they ended up basically cutting off the Bolshevik retreat. And then over the next several days, they marched into Volga without any serious resistance. And then they began the campaign to liberate Latvia, which lay to the north. I'm sorry, Latvia was to the south. They advanced into northern Latvia and began the war of liberation there, ultimately driving the Bolsheviks from Latvia as well. So despite being horrendously outnumbered, they were able to drive the Bolsheviks out of Estonia and Latvia within just about a year or two.
So when did they become Soviet republics?
The Soviets invaded them. I think wasn't that part of the secret agreement they made right around when they signed the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact in 1939 to divide Poland?
I was going to say, it would probably be after 1939.
Yeah, the Soviets annexed them after 1939.
It is reported from Wero, the rapidity with which the Estonian troops occupied Wero saved the lives of more than 200 people. There were 183 persons in prison for whom a similar fate was intended as befell those in Dorpat, which is a third town, right, on the 14th of January. The lists were already made out, but the Red Guard took flight at the approach of the Estonian troops, like roaches when you turn the light on. Only the warders remained behind, and they opened the prison doors. Altogether, some 100 people were to have been shot in Wero near the Russian cemetery, Kaiserichen Lake, and Karumpa Redoubt, wherever those places are. I guess they're places in the town. On the arrival of the rescuers, many of the graves were not yet filled in, and a number of bodies lay exposed in the snow. Several women were also shot, and especially ghastly was the murder of Fraulein Irmgard Kupfer. The following are the names of people who are known to have been murdered in Wero: Barber Kunz, Solicitor Piblack, house owners Condon Weirland, Forrester Matson from Erastware, Pastor Summer, and Herr Riemann or Vreeman. The names of most of the victims are unknown, for the greater number did not belong to Wero, but had been carried off from there from the neighboring villages and shot. The Bolsheviks also kept secret the number and names of their victims. They probably didn't care about the number and names of their victims. It has already been mentioned that according to the Bolshevik newspaper Tuline, that's with two O's and both of them have umlauts. I have no idea how to pronounce that. A number of counter-revolutionaries were murdered in Wero on the 14th of January. Now, information is brought by merchant P of Palwa, who was led to death with the above-mentioned victims, but who escaped the massacre. He reports the following. The 24 men who were condemned to death were led to a lake. They were ordered to undress and to run home. The victims obeyed, but scarcely had they turned their backs when the Bolsheviks fired a volley at them. P saved himself by throwing himself on the ground in good time. The Bolsheviks, thinking he was dead like the others, went off. Then P got up. He won't name him. It's just P. Then P got up and went away. Three of the four victims saved themselves in this way. Three or four victims saved themselves in this way, whilst the others were fatally shot by the Bolsheviks. A few days after the retreat from Dorpat, the Bolsheviks shot three people, namely Tak Walton and Antsal. According to later news, the following people were shot by the Bolsheviks: Stuart Hansen of the Aral Estate near Odenpa with his son, and Herr Seen, the owner of Sarjurl, or the owner of some establishment in Palway. It is reported from Walk that, among others, the Bolsheviks shot Police Inspector Koch and the former Ensign Rudolph. They carried away the following persons: Pastors Werner, Unz, Johns, Michelson, Priests Protopal, Sirnis, and Merchant Wasili. So they went after the pastors and the priests.
All right.
That they, this is representative. This is Estonia. This is going, they're going for, the Bolsheviks are going from village to village and killing all the notable citizens.
Anybody who might organize a counter-revolution.
Right, and these are only representative reports. These aren't complete accounts of what the Bolsheviks did. These are only representative reports of what they did in certain places. Well, when they, they had a much wider scope of operations than these reports even indicate.
All right. Number 54, summary of a report of the internal situation in Russia. The following is a summary of a report on the internal situation in Russia, which has been received from Mr. K., a member of the British Printers Trade Union who left Petrograd on 9th January 1919. Mr. K. was also a member of the Russian Printers Trade Union. He traveled extensively in Russia and was received everywhere as a working man. He had therefore an exceptional opportunity of studying the conditions in Soviet Russia. Reports have been received from various sources of the growing opposition to Bolshevik rule among a certain section of the Russian population, and Mr. K's account tends to confirm these reports. Conditions in the towns. Since the beginning of November 1918, there has been an increasingly strong feeling against the Bolsheviks among the intelligent portions of the working classes of Petrograd, Moscow, and other centers. In the early days of their power, the Bolsheviks were enthusiastically supported by the working classes in the towns, but latterly, the more enlightened have become convinced of the failure of the Bolshevik experiments at social reform. They have, however, nominally remained Bolsheviks, as there is no other alternative, since the Bolsheviks control the food supplies and hold all the arms in the country. And I'd like to pause here. Don't we see this in modern Zimbabwe and in every other country that the Jewish communists either have control over or have great influence in the government of? We see that in Zimbabwe they use hunger as a weapon, and they've shut down all the farms, knowing it will cause a general famine, but also knowing that since they have the military and they have the guns, they can control all the UN food shipments that come into the country, and if you're not loyal, you don't get anything.
Well, it's not only that, but most of the UN food shipments that come into those countries are seized and sold and never, ever, ever reach the intended recipients.
So we're basically paying for bandits, tin pot dictators, and thugs to sustain their own miserable lifestyle.
Well, right. And it's not even, it's very often even Jewish middlemen and merchants and transport the transport industry that does the seizing or the stealing.
Well, I'm sure the bandits, they have to know where the food is arriving and when it's arriving, and they don't just figure that out on their own. Someone has to tell them, okay, here's where you need all your people to be at 0800 hours.
There's all of that food aid. It's all a fraud. It's all a scam. And most of it's made off by middlemen. And if it's not made off by middlemen, then it's made off by the local chiefs. Very, very little of that so-called aid ever gets to its intended recipients. And the same thing will happen with Haiti. The Jews will rake off 90% of that, and the local thugs will get 9 of the other 10%.
Mr. K., in support of the foregoing, quotes views expressed to him by members of various factory staffs, and he cites cases of strikes in large factories, such as the Putilov, Ubakovsky, Truglenik, of which confirmation has been received from other sources. All factories are controlled by the Soviet of People's Economy. The commissars are inexperienced, and great difficulty is experienced in obtaining good workmen, with the result that the output of the factories has greatly decreased, in some cases to 10% of the original output.
I'm surprised it's that high. Well, when you take away all the impetus for a man to work, why do you expect him to work? And even the soft socialism of the United States, which hit our factories through the unions, and I saw this firsthand because I worked in factories when I was a kid. Nobody was with seniority. Nobody that was that was vested in the union would work hard. That they're not going to get any paid anymore for working harder. So they would all drag their butts around all day. I'm not saying there aren't any union people that do work hard, but it's clearly a detriment to productivity. And I equate the unions are a form of soft socialism here, and in Bolshevik Russia, no matter how hard you work, you're only getting a quarter pound of bread that day. So what are you going to do? You're not going to do a damn thing. You're going to do as little as possible to keep yourself from getting bayoneted.
In fact, in the Soviet Union, the harder you work, the more calories you burn, and you're not getting the bread to make up for that.
Well, right, that too. Absolutely.
No. Further confirmation of the reported opposition of a section of the working population to Bolshevik rule is found in a recent Bolshevik wireless message, which states that 60,000 workmen are on strike in Petrograd, demanding an end to fratricidal war, and the institution of free trade.
Fratricidal war, imagine that.
Now, are they referring to the war with Germany and Austria?
I don't know. It's hard to imagine. That very well could be it, but the Bolsheviks ended that, so they can't be referring to that.
Conditions in the country, are they referring to maybe the war with the Baltic states then?
They're probably referring to the fact that the Bolsheviks are using Russians that are willing to kill Russians against Russians. Yeah, you know, I mean, even though a great part of the army, the Bolshevik thugs, are Estonians and Letts and Chinese, they weren't all.
Absolutely.
A lot of them were Russians who knew that joining the service and joining the army and doing the will of the Bolsheviks was basically a ticket to a better meal and better clothing.
Conditions in the countryside. A similar change has occurred in the attitude of the better class peasants. At first, Bolshevik innovations were welcomed in the countryside, where also feeling was bitter against the English, who were accused of the desire to exploit Russia for their benefit. This attitude, however, underwent a change when the poverty committees were instituted. And here we can see that Russia, for really no benefit of its own, allied with England, mainly because the Tsar felt boxed in by Germany and Austria, and the Bolsheviks used that. They exploited this fact. They pointed out, look, the Tsar is throwing away the flower of Russia's youth in a war against Germany when it has no benefit for Russia. Russia shouldn't be allied with England. Yet at the same time, they wouldn't want Russia allied with Germany because that would basically take down England and France.
And it's, yeah, you know, the Jews play one side against the other here, and they always have. They know what they're doing. That they know, yeah, you know, the capitalist Jews pull us into these wars. And then the communist or the liberal Jews, they beat the drama, you know, the anti-war drums the loudest and lead the marches and attack the government and attack the media and they attack them, the establishment, and the establishment gives them all the attention. So what's up with that? There's a lot of dichotomies. There's a lot of hypocrisy, and there are a lot of things in society that happen that are outside of the scope of most people's vision. They just don't see what's going on, and that's, you know, the Jews they've done it on a large scale in Europe, and they do it on a very soft scale in the West.
All right.
On a very subtle scale, I should say.
These committees were composed of the worst elements of the villages, reinforced by Bolsheviks from the towns, with the result that village life became intolerable. Respectable peasants, to remedy this state of affairs, decided to join these committees with a view to exercising their influence upon them, and in many cases were successful. This led to a change in the constitution of the committees, and the Soviet authorities are now endeavoring to regain their former control in this respect. At the same time, the peasants' attitude of hostility towards the English disappeared, and the wish was expressed in many quarters that the latter would come and deliver Russia from Bolshevik rule. 3. Religious revival. Another important factor in the situation has been a strong revival of religious feeling in the towns and countryside. The result, apparently, of the revulsion caused by the wholesale persecution and murder of priests by the Bolsheviks. The change of attitude in this respect is manifest by the great increase in church attendance, which in the early days of Bolshevik rule was chiefly confined to women, and by the increasing boldness of priests in denouncing the Bolsheviks. It is noteworthy in the latter respect that the priests are acting with increasing impunity, a fact which appears to indicate that Bolsheviks are afraid of antagonizing the public opinion over this question. Anti-Bolshevik conspiracy. In the above connection, and as further evidence of the growing opposition in the interior to the Bolsheviks, it is of interest to note that, according to the Bolshevik wireless news of the 14th February, an anti-Bolshevik conspiracy on the part of left social revolutionaries has been discovered. The headquarters of the conspiracy were at Moscow. The leaders, it is stated, which include Madame Spiridonova, Steinberg, Trotsky, Protopovich, and Rosenblum, have been arrested, and the movement has apparently been completely forestalled. It is stated that documentary evidence shows that the object of these left social revolutionaries was to overthrow the Soviet government and to establish an all-Russian government. As a preliminary step, terrorist acts were to be carried out against local Soviet leaders, These, however, were to be carried out independently by local organizations with a view to avoid compromising the whole movement. Steps had been taken to institute anti-Bolshevik propaganda in the army and among the peasants who were to be incited to rise. The chief activities of this organization had apparently been directed towards White Russia, where in the Nashput, the Vilna organ of the Left Social Revolutionaries, an anti-Bolshevik agitation had already commenced. In White Russia, it was apparently the aim of this organization to seize power on the evacuation of the German forces. Note, it is noteworthy that at the same time as this reported conspiracy has been in progress, members of the Left Social Revolutionary Party, who formerly belonged to the Constituent Assembly at Ufa, had been negotiating with the Soviet government with a view of combining with the latter. It is not clear, therefore, how far these former members of the Constituent Assembly really represent the Left Social Revolutionary Party. End report.
And I think that, you know, it's my opinion that even though the Germans helped finance the Bolshevik Revolution because they were in a war against the Tsar, and they were fighting a war on two fronts, and that was a way out of one of those fronts. Actually, I'm sorry, they were fighting a war on three fronts because Italy was on the side of the English.
Italy switched sides, and they also had to fight in the Ottoman theater. So really they were fighting a war on four fronts.
So because even in spite of Germany's, you know, I don't think the Germans had any allegiance to the Bolsheviks.
No.
That they only financed them to get the Tsar off their backs.
Mm.
And once, if America never entered into the war, Germany would have held up in the West and would have never had to withdraw troops from Russia. The Bolshevik Revolution would have been defeated by the Austro-German forces. I'm convinced.
I don't think they ever would have put Lenin on a train and sent him east.
No, absolutely not.
And
no.
I certainly don't think they could have ever envisioned what was going to happen. And had they known, they wouldn't have done it. I think they just wanted to distract the Tsar and divert some troops away from the front lines to take some pressure off. I don't think they were intending to have the Bolsheviks come to power in Russia.
Oh, no, and destroy the whole Christian nation. I'm sure the Germans wouldn't have wanted that, but it happened.
Mm-hmm.
Number 55, a report by Mr. J. In making this report, I propose to deal with conditions as they appear to me at present, existing in such parts of Russia as are known to me, namely the Vladimir and Moscow government under the following headings. Food and price of same, wages, railways, education, the press, condition and feeling of the general public, business as a condition of industry. Number one, food of all kinds is difficult to obtain, and in many cases it is necessary for journeys to be taken in order to obtain the same. Prices are abnormal and in many cases entirely out of reach of all the classes. A system of rationing by means of cards is in force, but the quantity allowed per person varies according to the class of society to which such person belongs. The classification for bread is as follows. Laborers performing heavy manual work, 3/4 of a pound of black bread per day. Those doing lighter work, 1/2 pound of bread per day. Clerical workers, 1/4 pound per day. And after these, those living on capital, 1/8 of a pound per day. But we have reports that all the rich merchants already fled and were able to take their money. We read those last week, that they were able to take their money from the banks and go. The following were the prices in Moscow at the time I left. And those who could not pay these prices had either to go without or to make long journeys into the country for the purpose of trying to obtain food at a cheaper rate. But this is now becoming more and more difficult to do. Now, these must be black market prices because all food is, you know, is illegal to sell it.
And I'd also like to point out that if people notice, when you get into these prices, from the last report where we read prices, and it was only a few months ago, prices have now risen anywhere from 20 to 100%, depending on the item in question, in just about a month. They're going to see that.
Right. Black flour from 500 to 600 rubles per pud, which is 40 pounds. It is very difficult to obtain, being brought to Moscow in quantities of two or three puds, 80 to 120 pounds at a time, by Mesheknics, men who go to southern Russia and buy the flour there at from 60 to 100 rubles and bring the same to Moscow and sell at the price named above. So they're quintupling their money or 10 times their money on return for the trip. White flour cannot possibly be obtained. Meat is obtainable in very small quantities at the following prices. Soup meat, 25 rubles per pound. Mutton, 30 to 40 rubles per pound. Here we go again. Pork, 60 to 70 rubles per pound. Horse flesh has now become very scarce and very hard to obtain at 18 rubles per pound. Dog meat, two shops have opened in Moscow for the sale of this meat, the price being 6 rubles per pound.
Well, you know, they have to cater to the Chinese executioners.
I guess so, because they love dog meat. Sugar, very difficult to obtain at 60 to 65 rubles per pound. That's cheaper than it was a month before. Tea is very scarce indeed, even at the price of 150 to 200 rubles per pound.
That's twice what it was a month before.
Right. Butter, when the same can be obtained, costs 120 rubles per pound, but is now practically unattainable. No other fats are obtainable, with the exception of certain fish oil, which is the only fat available for cooking purposes. You would not want to cook your pancakes in fish oil, I'm sure. I guess they don't have pancakes because they don't have wheat. Potatoes are now very difficult to obtain, and then only at a cost of 160 to 200 rubles per pud of 40 pounds. Milk is very scarce indeed. Oats, very difficult to obtain. Price, 240 rubles per pud, six rubles per pound. The following articles cannot be obtained at any price. Coffee, cocoa, rice, and cereals. Wages. Wages have increased considerably. But despite this fact, the general body of workers are far worse off owing to the purchasing value of money having decreased far more proportionately than wages have increased. Workers in flour mills prior to the war were paid from 20 to 40 rubles per month and at present receive from 200 to 500 rubles per month. But evidently they can't buy anything with it.
It's mostly worthless currency at this point.
Well, right. When you have 500 rubles per month salary and pork costs 70 rubles per pound, well, you could buy about 7 pounds of pork to feed your family.
So that means you can eat once every 3 days.
And that's, you know, that's not the people. The salary is 200 to 500 rubles per month. So the guy making 200 rubles per month, he can't even buy himself 3 pounds of swine. And then they'll have no bread to eat it with, that's for sure. Yeah, it's clearly a difficult time. Prior to the war, bread cost 1 ruble and 80 kroner or something, some percentage of a ruble, 1.8 rubles, I would guess, per pud for 40 pounds. You could buy 40 pounds of bread for not even 2 rubles. Oh, a kopeck is
a kopeck.
Yes. And meat, 15 kopecks per pound. Now I'm guessing it's probably about 100 kopecks to a ruble, right?
Yeah, I believe so, yes.
A comparison with the present prices will show that workers are at present in a far worse position than previously. Well, that's obvious. And I can confidently state that many of them now realize this and would gladly revert to the old conditions if only this were possible. Oh, no, we should not have let Satan rule over us. That's my conjecture. Railways. Through lack of material and technical knowledge necessary to effect repairs. Well, they shot everybody, right? together with the increasing shortage of fuel and the reduction of output on part of the railway employees, consequent upon maladministration, disorganization, and lack of discipline, the locomotives and rolling stock available for traffic is rapidly decreasing. And as the number of persons desiring to travel is increasing, all trains are very much overloaded, and the passengers are often packed so tightly together as to be practically unable to move. It has been found necessary to use heavy goods engines through lack of light passenger engines for purpose of drawing passenger trains. And the only carriages now in use are similar to our cattle trucks. These trucks are packed, so packed that the decencies of life cannot be observed, one having often to remain there 36 hours or more before it is possible, owing to the pressure of fellow passengers, to descend. Under these conditions, transport by rail must eventually cease altogether. Number four, education. Education has practically ceased. The scholars have a president and committee who decide all matters concerning the respective school. In most schools, dining rooms have been opened, and the children are given free meals, and they practically only go to school in order to obtain food. But in many places, that sounds like our school lunch programs. That's exactly like our school lunch programs. And I'm sure a lot of our kids probably only go for a meal too. But in many places, owing to the uncleanly and filthy manner in which the food has been served, these dining rooms have had to be closed. Oh, well, there goes your meal, kid. Within my own knowledge, such a dining room in a small town in the Vladimir government had to be closed, the children having contracted venereal disease through the filthy condition of the utensils used in serving the meals.
I doubt it. I doubt that's how they contracted it.
That's probably not how they contracted it, but that's what they told their mothers. That's incredible. The press. Only two daily papers are issued in Moscow, i.e. the Izvestia of the Soviet and Pravda. Now, Pravda was originally Lenin's paper, wasn't it?
Absolutely, yes.
These papers are edited by leading Bolsheviks and, of course, contain only opinions and statements likely to further the cause of Bolshevism, and nothing is allowed to be published in any way antagonistic or to or critical of Bolshevism. That's the protocols of Zion. We will print lies. They do it all the time here. In January last, a weekly paper issued on a Wednesday called Feperid, supposed to be owned by the Menshevik Party, though considered to be controlled by the Bolsheviks, was allowed to be published. In this paper, articles were allowed to appear, which were a little more free, but the paper was stopped after the fourth number had been issued. It is the general opinion that if the truth were allowed to be published for a period of only one week, a great awakening of the people would result. Somehow I doubt it if it's anything like America.
In Pravda was primarily Trotsky's paper.
Oh, Trotsky's paper. I know. I knew one of them was, and I knew it belonged to one of them.
Trotsky founded it, and then Lev Kamenev did a lot of work for it after that. Just all Jews.
Number six, condition and feeling of the people. Suffering from malnutrition, lack of fuel, and the intense cold, also having nearly given up hope of the help of the Allied nations, which they have for so long been expecting and anxiously waiting, the educated professional and merchant classes are now entering upon a state of despair, resignation, and indifferences to all questions other than food. From my own experience, I can safely state that at least 80% of the population in the district where I resided, including both the educated, working, and peasant classes, are strongly opposed to the present masters of government and to Bolshevism. The fact that many of these people have joined the Red Guard is not of itself evidence of a belief in Bolshevism or in the government, but it is in the majority of cases a step taken in desperation for the purposes of obtaining food and other things which could not be obtained in any other manner, or through being made to join by the present system of compulsory mobilization. I am personally acquainted with several officers of the old army who have been compelled to join the Bolshevik army through fear of the consequences which would fall upon their near and dear relations should they refuse to do so. Should an officer of the old army fail to present himself when called upon to join the present Bolshevik army and evade arrest, his wife and children, if married, or his father and mother, if single, would be punished probably by imprisonment or worse. All these officers are strictly watched, and any occupying important positions have constantly with them a political commissar to whom all orders given must be shown and approved by him before being transmitted. Should disloyalty be suspected, the officer would immediately be shot. Desertion, both by officers and men in the front line, is very great and is upon the increase. All these people, both officers and men, are potential deserters to any outside force which would offer them protection and food. Prior to my leaving Moscow, typhus had broken out, claiming many victims, and was spreading rapidly, and it was feared that the spring and summer months would spread this disease to an uncontrollable extent. When I left, all hospitals were full, patients lying on the floors and in the corridors. 7. Business and conditions of industry. Private trading no longer exists, the only shops open being those of the Bolsheviks. Raw materials are scarce and difficult to obtain, and many factories and mills have been consequently closed. The provision of raw material for the flax mills have been placed in the hands of the Center Textile Committee, and no raw material may in the future be obtained directly. Though the committee had been in existence for several months, no raw material had been supplied by them to my mill up to the time of my leaving, and only 2 weeks' supply was then in hand, being the balance left from a large stock. For the past year, the workers have been in control of all mills, and as an example of the methods adopted, I state below the conditions appertaining at the mill where I was general manager, a mill employing 6,500 workers, two-thirds of whom were women and one-third men. In the first instance, a committee was elected from the workers by the workers. The committee consisted of 24 men, and from these, the following three subcommittees were formed: controlling committee, consisting of 6, food committee, consisting of 4, the enlightening committee, consisting of 4. The remaining 10 formed the Presidium, or the Council. The Presidium sat every day in a house by the mill yard from 9 a.m. till 3 p.m. So we know where all the food was and where all the food were. And the president of the Workers' Committee always provided at the sittings of the Presidium. Always presided at the sittings of the Presidium. The duties of the Presidium were to receive all complaints from the workers and adjust them to the workers' benefit, whether the complaint was of a reasonable nature or otherwise. The result was a continual, unnecessary, and annoying interference with the inside management of the mill. For instance, should the spinners complain, say, that number 14 yarn is working badly, they would call for the man superintending the material department and tell him to put in higher material without taking into consideration the loss incidental to such a procedure. This is a little too technical. It was therefore a constant battle to prevent the Presidium from doing this manner of injurious actions. The duties of the controlling committee are to control all buying and selling in connection with the mill. No money can be paid for goods delivered or for the work done without their signature. Nothing can be bought without their consent, and all articles bought in the district must be bought by the members of the committee themselves. So that's the extortion committee. Owing to these men, having no idea of the quality of an article, very often buy inferior goods at high prices than would be given by an expert. They control every action of and are constantly interfering with the administrative staff, and so confuse and bother the men employed on this work until they are unable to perform their duties and lose all interest and initiative. This kind of sounds like General Motors in the UAW. The food committee look after the obtaining and distribution of all foodstuffs, and are constantly traveling all over the country seeking food, but are very unsuccessful in this purpose and therefore have very little to distribute. Now, who can get food? The duties of the Enlightening Committee are rather obscure, but appear to consist first in the propagation of socialist principles. And they do this by buying literature of a socialistic nature, of course, for the workers' club, and second, in providing amusements for the workers by organizing concerts, dances, etc. The great desire of the members of all these committees seems to be to get commandeered either by the general meeting or by their own committee upon the grounds of urgency to go to some other town or district for some reason or other, and when they are on these expeditions, they receive 50 rubles per day for their expenses, besides their daily wage, which is paid out of the mill funds. And very often they have the possibility of receiving a good sum by the way of bribes when buying something for the mill. It sounds like General Motors and the UAW. All these committees, though elected in the first instance by the workers, by the majority of the workers, are now practically self-elected, as the majority of the workers are so inert, uninterested, and tired of the whole Bolshevik system that they do not trouble to attend for the purpose of voting. The elections generally take place at meetings with not more than 300 or less workers present out of the 6,500, and the members of the committee have generally arranged who will be chosen and have the supporters who arrange matters as required. All these committees very soon lose the trust of and are not in favor with those who have elected them, but are generally re-elected as stated before, and again the same things go on. The Zaksavoy committees. Besides the committees before named, in each department, 3 to 5 workers are elected as a department committee. The workers composing this committee are taken from their usual work and have an office in their particular department. They walk around the department keeping order and giving directions as to what is and what is not to be done. In the giving of these directions, the manager of the department concerned is often entirely ignored. Nothing can be done in each respective department without the members of the committee being informed and agreeing, and there is a constant friction and misunderstanding because of this. The manager finding it necessary to do certain things, and the committee not allowing him, and vice versa, in a majority of cases, the administration loses heart and does not protest, as if they go against the committee, there is a general meeting of the workers, and it is decided to discharge the manager or master who has gone against the workers. And this decision is carried out. This is the federal government. This is how they do things. This is our bureaucratic, socialistic federal government. This is how the U.S. Postal Service is run. In my own case, I prevented this taking place on several occasions with my managers by calling the committee together and informing them that if they discharge the manager concerned, I should throw up my situation and leave the mill. This threat having had the desired effect up to October 1918, I was able to adopt this attitude owing to the fact that I knew the majority of my workers held me in high esteem and trust, and it was known that in my 20 years of mill life in Russia, I never did anything in haste, and though very strict, tried to be just. In October 1918, I considered it desirable in my own interests to live in Moscow, and I then only visited the mill once a month. After I did this, 2 men were discharged, one the manager of our turf fields and one the head of superintendents. On January 1919, the mill was fully nationalized and the workers were ordered to elect a directorate of 5. I was the first director elected by the workers, only 2 voting against me out of 6,500. I mention this in order to show that my claim set out above to the esteem and respect of my workpeople is not an unfounded one. Below I give brief particulars of output obtained prior to and after the revolution. Output before the revolution. Mill working 18 hours a day. Spinning mill, 1,000 to 1,100 puds a day. Weaving mill, 800 to 8,500 pieces of linen cloth at 55 to 60 arshives each. Output winter of 1918-1919, mill working 16 hours per day, spinning mill, 450 to 500 puds per day. That's less than half. Weaving mill, 400 pieces per day. That's far less than half. The production was exceptional. As at other mills in our line, the turnover was much worse. For the last 9 months, the financing in the mill has been conducted in the following manner. To obtain money for wages, etc., we prepared invoices of finished goods and gave these into the Center Textile, who gave us 75% of the value of the invoice, and held the balance until the delivery of goods according to the instructions of the Central Textile, when the remaining 25% was paid. When presenting the invoice, an estimate showing in detail the proposed expenditure was also required by them. Always hoping that some change in the control of the mills might take place, and it being apparent that the systems at present in vogue could not permanently exist, our whole object was to retain in our warehouses as much as possible of the finished goods in order that, if the original owner was again allowed to take possession, goods would be available which could readily be turned into cash and so enable the owner to continue working the mill. This was the only step possible that could be taken to protect the original owner's property. When I left the above-mentioned mill, we had in the warehouse finished cloth goods to the value of about 30 million rubles. Foreigners such as myself remained at our positions to the last possible moment in hope of a normal government in Russia and return the property to its former owners.
All right. Number 56. Reverend B.S. Lombard to Earl Curzon. Officers' Quarters, 8th Rothsay Gardens, Bedford, March 23, 1919. My Lord, I beg to forward to your lordship the following details with reference to Bolshevism in Russia. I have been for 10 years in Russia and have been in Petrograd through the whole of the revolution. I spent 6 weeks in the fortress of Peter and Paul, acted as chaplain to His Majesty's submarines in the Baltic for 4 years, and was in contact with the 9th Russian Army in Romania during the autumn of 1917 whilst visiting British missions and hospitals, and had ample opportunity of studying Bolshevik methods. It originated in German propaganda and was and is being carried out by international Jews. So here we have, again, another person who blatantly, plainly, explicitly says Jews are working the revolution. And when he says German propaganda, I'm sure he actually means Jews from Germany.
He has to mean Jews from Germany.
The Germans initiated disturbances in order to reduce Russia to chaos. They printed masses of paper money to finance their schemes, the notes of which I possess specimens can be easily recognized by a special mark. Their tenets, radically, to destroy all ideas of patriotism and nationality by preaching the doctrine of internationalism, which proved successful amongst the uncultured masses of the laboring classes. To obstruct by every means the creation of military power by preaching the ideas of peace and to foster the abolition of military discipline. Now, don't the Jews always do this? They preach pacifism and peace, yet what they're really seeking is to get one country to disarm itself so it's weaker for another country that they're going to bring in to take it over.
Absolutely. All the time.
To keep the masses under the hypnosis of false socialistic literature. To buy up all nationalized banks and to open up everywhere branches of German government banks under the names and titles of firms that would conceal their actual standing. And I'm sure he's even more on the mark here than he realizes, since they're going to conceal them under Russian names to conceal the fact that they actually have German names, but they only took the German names to conceal the fact that they're Jews from Germany, not Germans from Germany.
Right, absolutely. And you know, they're printing all this money, and all these Jews owned all these newspapers. So who was printing? I mean, you need printing presses to print money, right?
Absolutely. To endeavor to impoverish and temporarily to weaken the peasant classes to bring about national calamities such as epidemics. The outbreak of cholera last summer was traced to this source, the wholesale burning down of villages and settlements. And did not Rahm Israel Emanuel, Obama's main handler, say, never let a good crisis go to waste?
Absolutely.
To preach the doctrine. Oh, sorry. Were you saying?
No, they do. They play up every crisis and use it to their advantage.
Absolutely. To preach the doctrine of the socialistic form of managing enterprises amongst the working classes, to encourage their efforts to seize such enterprises, and then by means of bankruptcies to get them into German hands. And this should really read Jews from Germany. to preach the idea of a 6 to 8 hours working day with higher wages, so less work, more pay. They always tell the masses they'll get something for nothing, the American dream, becoming rich through no effort of your own. That's what the Jews promote through Hollywood, whereas if you want to get ahead, it's going to require sweat. To crush all competition set on foot against them, all attempts of the intellectuals or other groups to undertake any kind of independent action or to develop any industries to be unmercifully checked, and in doing this to stop at nothing. Russia to be inundated by commission agents and other German representatives, and a close network of agencies and offices should be created for the purpose of spreading amongst the masses such views and teachings as may at any given time be dictated from Berlin. More like dictated from the Lower East Side of Manhattan, wouldn't you say?
Exactly.
The results. All businesses became paralyzed. Shops were closed. Jews became possessors of most of the business houses. Now, shouldn't he wonder if the Jews are possessing almost all of the businesses? Is this really a German instigated revolution?
Right. It's ridiculous to think so.
Jews became possessors of most of the business houses, and horrible scenes of starvation became common in the country districts. The peasants put their children to death rather than see them starve. In a village on the Divna, not far from Schulzelberg, a mother hanged three of her children. I was conducting a funeral in a mortuary of a lunatic asylum at Udonalia near Petrograd, and saw the bodies of a mother and her five children whose throats had been cut by the father because he could not see them suffer. When I left Russia last October, the nationalization of women was regarded as an accomplished fact, though I cannot prove that, with the exception of at Saratov, there was actually any proclamation issued. The cruelty of the soldiers is unspeakable. The father of one of the Russian clerks in the Vauxhall Motor Works was bound and laid on a railway line and cut to pieces by a locomotive on suspicion of having set fire to some of his own property. So if you burn a book to stay warm because you can't afford coal, that's counter-revolutionary instigation, isn't it?
Right. Especially if it's a Marxist book.
In August, last two barge loads of Russian officers were sunk, and their bodies washed up on the property of a friend of mine in the Gulf of Finland, many lashed together in twos and threes with barbed wire. This sounds like something out of a Steven Spielberg movie where the Germans are doing this to Jews, although it never happened that way.
All of their own behavior they projected onto the Germans, and they did it all. The only thing that's missing is the Zyklon B.
And the tattoos. But I guess they didn't have a need to tattoo them because they were just killing them in minutes or hours. They weren't keeping them around for months.
Right.
While we were in prison, a Red Guard was sent from the central police station, Gorokhaya 2, in charge of five prisoners to the fortress. One of them, an old officer, was unable to walk. The guard shot him and left his body on the Trotsky Bridge. The murderer was reprimanded and imprisoned in a cell near ours. The treatment of priests was brutal beyond anything. And I'm shocked they would actually imprison the guard, aren't you?
Yeah, I couldn't understand why.
Maybe they thought he was showing too much initiative by shooting the man. Eight of them were incarcerated in a cell in our corridor. Some of us saw an aged man knocked down twice one morning for apparently no reason whatever, and they were employed to perform the most degrading work and made to clean out the filthy prison hospital. Recently, life in Petrograd has become a veritable nightmare. In the early days of 1917, the Russians gloried in a bloodless revolution. Now they simply glut themselves with killing for the most trivial offenses. In a market on the opposite side of the river to my house, a poor woman with a starving family filched a small piece of meat from a stall. Without any hesitation, the Red Guard surrounded her and, placing her against the wall, shot her dead. The rank and file of the Red Army is full of men who are heartily sick of the present regime and would gladly join any really strong force sent to the relief of the country. Isn't this theme again and again throughout all these reports, that they're just waiting for outside forces to come in and help them, and they're waiting to organize around them whenever they have materialized, but they never materialized.
They never materialized.
But unless the force were considerable, they would hesitate. But I imagine that the food question is the key to the situation. The Red Armies must be at a low ebb for provisions, and by getting stores to Helsingfors, they might be treated with. I am, etc., Bousfield S. Lombard, Chaplain to the Forces. End report.
I would like to, I mean, I know it's getting late, but I would like to read from a booklet by a
Catholic
priest named Dennis Fahey, and it's in reference to these reports. Again, thank you, General Mosley. And this is from the rulers of Russia. And this was written in 1938. In this pamphlet, I present to my readers a number of serious documents which go to show that the real forces behind Bolshevism in Russia are Jewish forces, and that Bolshevism is really an instrument in the hands of the Jews for establishment of their future messianic kingdom. Since Bolshevism, on its own confession, does not intend to remain within the narrow limits of any one country, but ambitions a worldwide influence or empire, the importance of this documentation is manifest. It is certain that many Catholics are ignorant of these facts and of their implications. When one realizes that communism is an instrument intended to prepare for the coming of the natural messiahs, one can understand the intensity of the hatred of communists against the mass and against priests, as well as the malignity of the propaganda in every country against the religious orders of the Catholic Church. Now he's, you know, he's a Catholic priest, so of course he's writing from an entirely Catholic perspective. It is more than probable that many professing communists, even some amongst the paid orators and agents of communism, are unaware of the final goal of their employers and trainers. The attention of these dupes should be drawn to the facts that they should be asked for full explanations. While stressing the inescapable nature of the conclusions to be drawn from the documents quoted below, I desire at the outset to emphasize the fact that the methods to be adopted by Catholics to frustrate preparations for the kingdom of the natural Messiah should always and everywhere be in accordance with the teachings and the spirit of the supernatural Messiah, our Lord Jesus Christ. Mr. Hilaire Belloc writes in GK's Weekly, February 4, 1937, "As for anyone who does not know that the present revolutionary Bolshevist movement is Jewish in Russia, I can only say that he must be a man who is taken in by the suppressions of our deplorable press. It is a strong statement. What is the evidence to support it?" The rulers of Russia in 1917, in the book The Mystical Body of Christ in the Modern World, two documents are quoted in proof of the fact that the Jews were the real rulers of Russia after the Bolshevik Revolution. The first document, quoted on page 88, is the report forwarded. Now, we read this report. Is the report forwarded by London by Mr. Oudendijk, the representative of the Netherlands government at St. Petersburg, when the Bolsheviks began their reign of terror. Mr. Balfour received the report via Christiana on the 18th of September, 1918. It was published as a British white paper in April 1919, and it was entitled Russia Number 1, 1919, a collection of reports on Bolshevism in Russia. This is the report we're reading from.
Absolutely.
And Dennis Fahey wrote about it, and I'm quoting from it right here, in 1938. The kernel of the paper is contained in the following extract from Mr. Oudendijk's report. "The danger is now so great that I feel it my duty to call the attention of the British and all other governments to the fact that if an end is not put to Bolshevism at once in 1919 or 1918, the civilization of the whole world will be threatened. This is not an exaggeration, but a sober matter of fact. I consider that the immediate suppression of Bolshevism is the greatest issue now before the world, not even excluding the war, which is still raging," meaning World War I, "and unless, as above stated, Bolshevism is nipped in the bud immediately, it is bound to spread in one form or another over Europe and the whole world. As it is organized and worked by Jews, who have no nationality and whose one object is to destroy for their own ends the existing order of things. The only manner in which this danger can be averted would be the collective action on the part of all the powers. Fahey continues now, the foreword to the white paper stated that it was issued in accordance with the decision of the English War Cabinet in January 1919. The subsequent history of this white paper is extraordinary. It speedily disappeared from circulation and became unobtainable. Then an abridged edition was issued with the same title, and it cost 6 shillings instead of 9 shillings, or six, whatever that D stands for. I don't even know. I'm not British. From the abridged edition, the passage we have quoted and some more had been eliminated. It has never been possible to ascertain how the original document was suppressed. So there we have it. Dennis Fahey writing about the Russia number one report that we've been reading for 6 weeks now and saying that it was suppressed and it was replaced by a lesser document, and he was saying that in 1938.
And Gerald gave me a facsimile copy of the abridged edition, and they've basically gutted it. They've taken all the meat out of it.
Well,
they've removed
they
all the references.
They took all the Jews out of it, I'm sure.
Absolutely, every reference to the Jews. They shortened the letter from Mr. Oudendijk, the Dutch ambassador. They shortened it by about a page and a half. The paragraph that we read where it says Jews who have no nationality, yada, 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 Bolshevism will spread in one form or another across the whole world and all the powers must unite, that paragraph is lifted out entirely. And that's probably the most important part of that letter. Because it explicitly and clearly spells out who was working the revolution and the great threat to the world.
Absolutely. Russian Jews destroyed Christianity in Russia, and American Jews financed it, and then American Jews propped up Russia as a great enemy so that they could loot and pillage all of Europe and America.
And now they've destroyed Christianity in the entire world.
Well, they haven't quite got that far, but yeah, they've basically decimated it.
They've gotten it to the point where most of what passes as Christianity today is absolutely pathetic, claptrap, gutter nonsense. And it occurred to me today while driving down the road, going by 4 or 5 churches in about a quarter mile, that never before have we had so many churches per capita or an absolute number of churches in this nation, yet there's a great famine for the truth, isn't there?
Well, that's because Christianity today is the best Christianity that the Jews could buy. And they paid for it, and they bought it, and they deserve it. I mean, it's not Christianity at all. It's not even Messianic Judaism.
It's basically just it's almost just like a social clique or some sort of group therapy where the people go in there, and it's almost like an AA meeting.
Absolutely. It's all New Agey and freakish, and it's not Christianity at all.
All right, so we will pick up next week with installment number 7.
Praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh. Thank you.
Thank you.